President Trump's signature tax and spending law includes almost $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid. So who stands to lose their coverage? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss the impact of the legislation locally and who could be kicked off the program, our family physician, Dr. Josh Smith. Thanks for being here, Dr. Smith.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
And Washington Center for Equitable Growth Senior Policy Fellow, Michael Linden. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate your both being here. Michael, who in general is covered by Medicaid?
That's a great question. So Medicaid covers about 70 million people nationwide. It covers about half of all nursing home care in the country. It covers low-income families, especially low-income families with children. And it also covers a lot of people with disabilities. Most people on Medicaid are either children, elderly, caregivers, or are working. And almost everybody on Medicaid is of low or moderate means, although many middle-class families do rely on Medicaid, especially to help care for elderly parents.
And does it also cover some people who are on Medicare?
There are some people who are what's known as dual eligible. They are they can be on both Medicare and Medicaid at the same time. Yes.
What changes will this legislation make to the program, Michael?
So the program, this bill has made the largest changes to Medicaid in a long time. Big cuts, largely, about $1 trillion. And there's a bunch of different things that will change. First of all, the program will now require many, many more people to prove that they are working more regularly and more frequently. Most people on Medicaid do work. Only about 3% of total Medicaid recipients are of working age and don't work. But because of these requirements, many people who are currently eligible will be kicked off the program because they can't keep up with the paperwork, or maybe because their employer doesn't give them enough hours in a given month. That's a pretty significant change. That's never really been the case in Medicaid before. So many, many people will lose their insurance because of that. There are some other important changes people should know about. There are going to be new co-pays for Medicaid recipients, so it'll cost more to go to the doctor for many Medicaid recipients. And then the big thing in addition to all of that is there's just going to be less funding for states. Many states will, you know, Medicaid is a partnership between the federal government and state governments, and the federal side of that is going to go way down. And so that means states are either going to have to pick up the tab by raising taxes on everybody or cut people off of the program to meet their budgets. So in total, the estimate is that roughly 12 million people who are currently receiving Medicaid or receiving healthcare through Medicaid will lose their coverage over the next several years.
Dr. Smith, I know you work with patients who rely on Medicaid. What are the circumstances some of your Medicaid patients are dealing with?
It's a great question, Lucy. I think Medicaid recipients vary quite a bit, of course. As Michael mentioned, Medicaid and its child healthcare program, CHIP, are the largest insurers of for children in the country. And then there are young working people who just don't make enough in order to provide for private health coverage. And of course, if their employers aren't providing employer-assisted health coverage, then their options are the ACA marketplace or state-funded and federally funded Medicaid. So there's no one type of person on Medicaid. It ranges from, you know, healthy people in their 20s who just are working in the gig economy and don't have employer-sponsored insurance, to people in their 50s and 60s who aren't yet qualifying for Medicare. And again, just either don't have stable employment, their employers aren't providing health coverage, or they just aren't able to hold down a job because they're navigating illness or they're taking care of family or they're in school trying to qualify for that next step in their career. The Medicaid population is a really heterogeneous population, and a lot of folks fall into it.
With all that variation, Dr. Smith, is there a way to describe how Medicaid really helps your patients overall? You know, just what it means to them?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's really important for us to remember that when people have insurance, they're more likely to come and get those crucial preventative care services that I, as a family physician, and my colleagues, as other primary care physicians, provide. You know, an ounce of preventative care is always worth a pound of cure. And if somebody is going to forgo those preventative and primary care services, like those people who are uninsured do, they're more likely to end up with more severe health consequences down the line. They're ending up in emergency departments and hospitals, contributing to the overcrowding of hospitals and the long wait times in the emergency department. You know, I've had patients who, through no fault of their own, have ended up losing their health insurance coverage, whether it's through paperwork and bureaucratic mistakes or because they lost their jobs in the midst of the COVID pandemic. And they didn't come see me for 1 to 2 years. And when they finally ended up back in the office, their blood pressure was out of control. Their kidney disease had progressed. Their heart disease had progressed. Their diabetes had progressed. Most of them requiring 2, 3, 4 more prescriptions, another specialist referral, and sometimes needing to go to the hospital. And this is just our healthcare system was already stressed, and Medicaid really underlies the stability of our healthcare system. And I'm quite worried about what's going to happen to our system with these cuts.
That's an important point. I think a lot of us think about the need to go to the emergency room and crisis situations where you need medical help. But you're saying that this primary care that Medicaid provides is just critically important.
Absolutely. And I think something important in the legislation is that that cost-sharing mechanism doesn't seem to be affecting primary and preventative care along with prenatal or pediatric care. It really seems targeted at specialty care. But this thought that folks on Medicaid don't require specialty care is naive at best and harmful at worst. I think it's going to make it harder, even if it's just a $40 copay, to go see a kidney specialist or a heart specialist. My patients who are now responsible for that copay are more likely to forgo that specialty care. It's going to further stress our primary care infrastructure, which is, again, already stressed nearly to a breaking point due to other issues that are beyond the scope of our conversation today.
We're talking about what the changes in federal law could mean for Medicaid patients and access to health care. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Smith, Michael was talking before about work requirements, the paperwork, and kind of bureaucracy that's added to the system. What would these work requirements mean for your typical patients?
Well, I think it's less of the actual work requirements because, as Michael pointed out, more than 90% of people receiving Medicaid benefits already qualify based on the work requirements put forth. Whether it's they're employed or they're in school, they're taking care of family members, or they're navigating illness. The bigger issue is this semiannual reporting requirement. This is a massive paperwork effort and a massive bureaucratic lift. Having to prove that you are working 80 hours per month every 6 months would be hard for somebody with a stable job, with stable housing, without any semblance of food insecurity. And again, those folks receiving Medicaid are disproportionately experiencing housing instability, food insecurity, and job instability. And so now asking them, who are also disproportionately affected by lack of internet access or living too far away from a public library or a public access for internet, is for most people going to be an insurmountable barrier. And they're not going to lose Medicaid because they don't qualify for Medicaid. They're going to lose Medicaid because they forget to file their paperwork every 6 months. And that's, I think, really where we're going to see a lot of the detrimental effects of this legislation.
Michael, this is a point of discussion that came up for us in the newsroom the other day. Is it the case that states can seek payment of repayment of Medicaid costs from a person's estate after they die? We've heard it described as estate recovery. Is that something you mentioned that there are a lot of older adults who count on Medicaid? Is this something that's part of the program?
You know, that's a good question. And I'd have to get back to you on the specifics of it. I don't think that is a big part of the law that has just changed.
Okay.
But it is, I do want to emphasize something that Dr. Smith just said. You know, the estimates are that several million people will lose their insurance because of these paperwork and re-eligibility certifications. And that's many, many more than are estimated to be not currently working, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of the key thing here, is that the cuts come from kicking people off the program who are currently eligible. And it's worth noting, especially, that the budgetary impact of that, the stated reason why this bill was passed to save money, doesn't go to invest in healthcare someplace else or to reducing the deficit. That money is going to pay for tax cuts, which was the other large part of the bill, tax cuts that primarily benefit the wealthy and corporations.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that 12 million Americans number, because that's the estimate that we've heard from the Congressional Budget Office. I was reading this conservative commentary the other day that said, oh, the CBO has underestimated enrollment predictions in the past. They've got these numbers wrong in the past, that they're just bad at estimating these numbers. Do you feel like that's a trustworthy number, that 12 million number?
I think it is a trustworthy number. I mean, we should remember that the Congressional Budget Office is headed by a Republican appointee, a man who served under George W. Bush in the Treasury Department, appointed by Republicans in Congress and then reappointed. This is not, look, predictions are always hard. Nobody knows what the future will hold. But we do know what happens when you impose these kinds of policies on Medicaid. It's been tried in several places, in Arkansas, in Georgia, in New Hampshire. And exactly what Dr. Smith and I have been saying, and what the CBO has been saying, that's exactly what happened. People lost their coverage. People who were eligible, otherwise eligible for the program, lost their coverage. Will it be 12 million exactly? Probably not. It could be 13. It could be 15. It could be 10. But directionally, there's no question that it will be millions of people who will lose their coverage. And this idea that nobody will be hurt by the program, by these program cuts, is belied by the fact that the same people in Congress who cast doubt on those projections are happy to accept that it will save, quote unquote, save $1 trillion. Where do those savings come from? It comes from people no longer being covered by the program.
Yeah. Well, we are going to continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, we'll talk about how to determine if an older adult is safe at home and where to get help. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about Medicaid and what changes in federal law could mean for patients and access to health care. My guests are family physician Dr. Josh Smith and Washington Center for Equitable Growth Senior Policy Fellow Michael Linden. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Smith, one of the other concerns I've heard about are these reports that these changes to Medicaid could result in hospitals closing too. How would that work?
Well, I think what it really comes down to is not just the moral obligation of physicians to treat patients, but the legal obligation of physicians to treat patients. Outside of just the litigious system in which we live, we have laws that mandate that physicians treat and stabilize patients, particularly in emergency departments, but also in hospitals. And so when people are foregoing primary care and preventative care, when they're foregoing their prescriptions, as folks without insurance tend to do disproportionately, they get sicker. They come to the emergency department and they get admitted to the hospital. And just because nobody's paying for their care doesn't mean that that care isn't being provided. And so these hospitals are going to be expected to take on the lion's share of these costs. Now, it's traditionally referred to as charity care, but at this point, we're just asking hospitals to eat the cost of the social safety net. And at least in Ohio, there are at least 20 different hospitals, when I last looked, that are operating currently at a financial loss, 8 as of April that were at risk of closure, and losing the Medicaid funding. And that, you know, even though it's less than private insurance and that compensation is less than Medicare compensation, it's still compensation. And being compensated for care is better than not being compensated for care. And these hospitals just are not going to be able to sustain themselves without the Medicaid funding. And I'm very, very concerned that this is going to push those hospitals over the edge.
Michael, I know Senate Republicans added, I think it was $50 billion to the legislation specifically for rural hospitals. Will that address the concerns about hospitals?
I mean, it's a Band-Aid, not to use the healthcare pun here, but they are taking several hundred billions of dollars away from rural hospitals through the cuts to Medicaid, and then giving back $50 billion. So in the net effect will be a significant cut to rural hospitals, and the Rural Hospital Association has said this is not sufficient. This is going to lead to many hospitals closing, and I think it's, you know, something that Dr. Smith said, which is really important for people to understand. Medicaid is already a very lean program. It is paying for care and coverage at a much lower cost than private insurance and lower cost than Medicare. So it's not as if there was a lot of so-called fat that you could trim. So if you cut this funding, yes, rural hospitals will feel the brunt. So will urban hospitals, but rural hospitals in particular, because so much of the care is covered by Medicaid. And a $50 billion fund over the next however long these cuts are in effect, is just not sufficient. And many, many hospitals will close. Similarly, it's worth noting that nursing homes are also at significant risk of closing because of similar revenue concerns. You know, I mentioned at the top, Medicaid pays for almost half of all nursing home care in this country, and many nursing homes are very reliant on that reimbursement to make the numbers work.
Michael, one of the things I learned about as I was trying to study up for this conversation was the concept of provider taxes. I wasn't familiar with that term before. Can you explain what provider taxes are and whether this new law will end up limiting how states use them?
Yes. So at a very high and sort of simple level, remember that Medicaid is, as I said, a state and federal partnership. And the way it works is that the federal government matches a certain portion of state investment. And what provider taxes are effectively is a way for states to raise more money to put into Medicaid and then get a bigger match from the federal government. It's just a funding mechanism that states use to increase their funding for Medicaid. This bill limits that mechanism. And the upshot is that it just reduces the amount of Medicaid funding that will be available both for states and then therefore from the federal government. And it's a very large cut. And that is one of the major cuts that will be felt by all Medicaid recipients, because it simply says, okay, states, you've got to either pick up a bigger share of the tab yourself, or people are just going to have to go without. So that's what it is. And obviously can get pretty complicated, but at the end of the day, it's just a mechanism that states use to increase their funding for Medicaid. And now they will not be able to do that.
And I guess the people who are for cutting the provider tax say, hey, the states shouldn't be able to get more federal funding through this mechanism. Is that sort of the argument in favor of what's being done?
Yeah, the argument is that they just, I guess the argument is that states should either pick up a bigger share of their own Medicaid tab one way or the other. And it's a little bit short-sighted, if you ask me, because look, we all end up paying for healthcare. As Dr. Smith said, we are all better off when we have a more robust healthcare system that is covering preventative care, that, you know, that people feel comfortable going to the doctor when they need it or before they need it. And so simply saying, well, states, you guys go ahead and pick up the tab, that's all well and good, but somebody will pay for that. And that may mean, like I said, either lower Medicaid rolls or higher taxes. And many states will choose, may choose to raise taxes to cover the cost, and many states won't be able to do that.
We got
Lucy, if you don't mind, I also think, just to pile on there, that Michael said something important, that if one person says, I'm not paying for this, somebody else is going to pay for it. And I think it, like Michael said, this is very short-sighted to think, well, we can just say we're not going to pay for Medicaid anymore and they'll figure it out. And this is not an us versus them situation. This affects all of us, because when these hospitals and health systems are struggling with their bottom line, eventually they're going to pass those higher costs on to those people who still have insurance, whether it's private insurance, employer-sponsored insurance, or Medicare. They are going to increase the our health insurance companies are going to increase the premiums. We're going to increase our co-pays, and the supply is going to be limited, driving up price. I think Michael hit the nail on the head, that the best words that I can find to describe this legislation is short-sighted.
We got an email from Joan. Joan writes, unless very wealthy or already on Medicare, everyone is only one major accident away from needing social services like Medicaid. That kind of gets to the point you were making, Dr. Smith, about how this can affect all of us. You know, we keep hearing the argument that people are gaming the system. These able-bodied adults who could be working aren't working. But I've also heard the argument that Medicaid can't pay your rent. There's only so much you can get from Medicaid. So I guess I wonder, Michael, I'll start with you. Do you think people are gaming the Medicaid system?
You know, no, is the short answer. I mean, of course, and we are a large country. There are 70 million people who get their coverage in part through Medicaid. Are there individual circumstances where we might say, you know, maybe that person could be doing something else? Of course. But the vast majority of these families are people who need the care, are getting the care, are doing the right thing. They're working hard. And the idea that we are going to kick 17 million people off of their health insurance, in total 12 million off of Medicaid, to try and solve what is essentially a non-existent problem, is very frustrating to me. And it's disingenuous, to be honest with you, because that's not really what this bill was about. This bill started with $4.5 trillion of tax cuts as its starting point, and then Congress had to find some ways to pay for that or partially pay for it. And that's why they're going after Medicaid, not because it's filled with people who don't, quote unquote, deserve it. I really think it's almost a silly argument to think somebody is living large off of Medicaid. It doesn't pay your rent. It doesn't pay for food. It's medical care, and it's not exactly generous medical care at that.
On the other end of the spectrum, Dr. Smith, people argue that, you know, these cuts, these changes, people could die as a result. Do you think that's true, or is that overblown?
Oh, absolutely. We are going to see a dramatic rise in morbidity and mortality from these cuts. I mean, even if you just imagine if the wait time in an emergency department stretches out from the already long 8 hours to 12 hours because, well, the local nursing home closed, so we have no place to discharge the patient who's currently in the hospital, which means we have no bed in which to put that person from the emergency department to be cared for in the hospital, we're going to see this immense backup. And that's not even to discuss the rural hospitals that are going to close. And, you know, the difference between life and death when somebody's having a heart attack can be 15 minutes. Hmm. The increase in transportation time, if a rural hospital closes, might go from 30 minutes to an hour and 30 minutes. Ohio is not a huge state, but it's a big state. And we do not have the rural or urban healthcare infrastructure to sustain the rural and urban hospitals that will close because of these cuts.
Well, I've been talking with family physician Dr. Josh Smith and Washington Center for Equitable Growth Senior Policy Fellow Michael Linden. Thank you both so much for your time today and for this important conversation.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, we'll discuss how you can figure out if older loved ones are safe in their homes. This is Cincinnati Edition.